joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The final debate of Campaign 08 highlighted wide differences between Senators McCain and Obama on taxes, energy, health care, abortion, and the tenor of their campaigns. In a speech to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the president tried to reassure the public on the economy and defend the government's role in the financial rescue package. And the chairman of the FDIC criticizes the plan's failure to do enough to prevent Americans from losing their homes. Joining me for this week's Friday News Roundup, Andrew Sullivan of The New Republic, Karen Tumulty of Time Magazine, and Jerry Seib of The Wall Street Journal. Of course, we invite your calls, your comments, and questions. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Karen Tumulty, the morning started out with some bad news on housing starts and a speech from President Bush. What did the housing starts tell us? What did President Bush have to say?
Well, the housing starts, both single family and overall, are at their lowest level in decades. This suggests that we are not yet at the bottom or even all that near the bottom of the decline in the real estate market, which really is the underlying factor driving a lot of these other economic problems. So the president came out this morning and tried, I think, to reassure the public on all of this. But, probably it was not the best choice of words to refer to these recent measures as the last resort. This is not exactly going to be perhaps what is going to calm people down the most. But basically, the president is trying to explain that the steps that the government has taken to ease up the credit crisis, both in bailing out Wall Street and in buying piece ownership stakes in banks, is something that he wouldn't be doing under ordinary circumstances.
Andrew Sullivan, what did you see? What did you hear? How did you interpret what you heard?
I kept hearing in my mind, we're in the last throes of this housing crisis. I mean, there is a point at which, and it's remarkable, really, that we don't really have a president acting in the way that a president would normally act. The person you really want to reassure you at this moment is President Bush. He's the president of the United States. In fact, the real leadership came from Gordon Brown in Britain, the prime minister of the United Kingdom, adopting a measure that the American government actually decided against a few weeks earlier. And we rely on Paulson and even, I think, Obama already prematurely for calm. Bush, at this point, I think largely because of Katrina and Iraq, is unable to use the authority of the office to calm people or the markets. And I think until this election is resolved, the markets will not stabilize. They need to know that there is a grown-up back in the White House at some point.
I found it interesting, Jerry Seib, that the president seemed to mount a defense of what he called democratic capitalism. What does that mean?
Well, it means government intervention in the marketplace in a big way, and in what will be a sustained way, because this is going to go on for a while. I think part of what the president's mission was in that speech was to say to conservatives, I have not abandoned my principles. You don't have to abandon your principles to support the government acting in a period of extreme duress and doing things it normally wouldn't do or that we normally wouldn't approve of it doing. I think partly that was a defense of his own administration's actions. I think partly it was an attempt to build support among skeptics for a change in the way the government deals with the marketplace and with capitalism in general that's going to go on for a while yet.
So how will the government's partial nationalization of the banks work And, you know, are there other new tactics he can pull out of the bag?
Sure. There are still some tricks left in the bag, contrary to what some people think. I mean, the bank investment was a pretty substantial change in the plan, in the game plan the administration had just 2 weeks ago. And it was a change dictated or suggested largely by the British, by the British government, which decided the best way to freeze up the credit markets and to get money moving was not to buy up bad loans, which is a long and laborious process, but to take government money and inject it directly as capital into banks, and to take back in return some ownership share of those banks for a while. That's what the Treasury Department decided to do this week. The idea is to hold those shares for a maximum of 3 years temporarily, get money moving, and then back out of the process.
Well, we keep seeing this wild ride on the stock market. So what does that say about their confidence?
Well, one of the things that happened this week was at the beginning of the week, the market went way up because people looked at this move to inject capital directly into banks and said that may solve the markets crisis. The financial firms and the banking community might now have the money they need to both survive and to lend money. That's great. 2 days later, I think the market then looked at the other leg of the stool, which is the real economy, which is to say the place where people buy cars and buy houses and buy clothes and shop for Christmas presents, and said, oh, yeah, there is a recession that's either here or coming very quickly. And even if the markets are fixed, that's going to play out, and things went down. The other thing that's happening, just as a footnote, is one of the reasons the markets go up and go down is that you have a lot of hedge funds and mutual funds that when the market goes up, they pull out cash because they know they're going to be customers at the end of the year who are going to want their money back, and they need to have a cash reserve built up so that they can make those redemptions. So that creates volatility. If you're in the market, I think you probably just have to put up with that for a while.
So is the plan having an impact on the credit markets, Karen?
Well, it should, and especially recapitalizing the banks, because that is a far more direct and, as Jerry said, a far quicker way of sort of getting more lubrication into the system. But part of this is psychological, too. I mean, the banks just don't trust each other anymore. And so, it is going to take a little bit of time for the mindset to change in addition to the, you know, just amount of liquidity that is out there.
Karen Tumulty of Time Magazine, Jerry Seib of The Wall Street Journal, Andrew Sullivan of The Atlantic, and also a columnist for Time Magazine. No longer. All right. We'll take
our
that
loss
out. And if you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Jerry, yesterday, your newspaper, The Wall Street Journal, reported some very critical words that the FDIC chair had for the government's rescue plan. What did Sheila Bair say?
Well, what she said, and she's the chief bank regulator, really, of the federal government, that she thinks the rescue package overall ought to be doing more to help homeowners deal with their individual distressed and imperiled mortgages. In other words, do more to prevent foreclosures at the retail level. I think there may still be more coming on this. And when you asked before whether there's more the government can do, John McCain has been out on the campaign trail saying, let's just have the government spend some money, and he says $300 billion, to buy up bad mortgages directly from consumers and then renegotiate those with the government. I still think that's a possibility. I think Sheila Bair in those words was suggesting she doesn't think that's a bad idea.
Huh.
I still think it could happen.
How soon?
Soon.
Soon.
I mean, as we've seen this week, the Treasury Department is continuing to rethink how they spend that $700 billion Congress gave them a couple of weeks ago.
You know, the problem with that, though, and the McCain campaign has explained this program several different ways, but is that if you go out and buy these mortgages at face value, what you're essentially doing is making the bankers whole at the expense of the taxpayers. So I think that to sell something like this politically, you're going to have to convince people that there is some kind of mechanism in place where the government will be buying these mortgages at a fair market value, not at what they were worth when they were issued a year ago or two years ago.
Well, Andrew Sullivan of The Atlantic, that is going to mean that the next administration, no matter who's in office, is going to face the nation's most difficult economic times that we've seen the last 70 years. What's the approach going to be?
Well, I think they're going to have to make a decision, a very early decision, which is going to be a very tough decision, which is do we spend anyway? Or do we, given the fact that they've added $5 trillion to national debt in the last 8 years, doubling it, given that under the Bush administration we've added $32 trillion to future unfunded liabilities, I mean, the most fiscally profligate administration in American history. So the cupboard's bare, less than bare, but if you were to tighten the screws even further, you might tip the entire recession into a Great Depression. And I think that's going to be, if it is President Obama or if it's President McCain. President McCain has said he will, you know, really...
Senator McCain.
Senator McCain has said that his first duty will be spending cuts. Well, look, there are moments in the economic cycle when that is not the wisest thing to do. So whoever does get this poison chalice is going to be a depression president. And I hope that whoever it is, the American people understand that that person needs to be given a new chance. I mean, he can't be pummeled from word go, whether it's McCain or Obama, because the economy is in a terrible state.
Yeah, I think the motto these days is we are all Keynesians now because of the situation of the economy. But even organizations like the Concord Coalition, which has been all about fighting the deficit, even they are saying right now government spending is needed.
Karen Tumulty, reporter for Time magazine, Andrew Sullivan of The Atlantic, and Jerry Seib, he's executive Washington editor for The Wall Street Journal. Short break and your calls. I look forward to hearing from you. Welcome back to our Friday News Roundup this week with Jerry Seib of the Wall Street Journal, Karen Tumulty of Time magazine, and Andrew Sullivan, senior editor at The Atlantic. Karen Tumulty, how do you think the third and final debate between the two presidential candidates compared with the two earlier ones?
Well, it was several debates, actually. It was a debate about economic policy. It was a debate about the negative tone that the campaign was taking. And then it was in one of the sillier, I think, aspects was it became a debate about one single plumber in Ohio.
Who turns out to owe some tax money, we ought to mention.
Right. But I think that, you know, there wasn't a lot that was said that was new in the debate. And ultimately, Barack Obama was judged the winner, I think, in all of the polls afterward, less because of anything he said, but I think because of his demeanor, which is really what has carried him through all of these debates. And really, he's acquitted himself well.
Andrew Sullivan, what did you think of McCain's performance and the fact that he did refer to Joe the Plumber about 20 times?
I think it was on a par with his fall campaign performance, which is extraordinarily patchy and rough and temperamentally very unnerving. I felt like he seemed the entire debate about to explode. and didn't, which is a horrible one. The explosion with John McCain is often the relief. And once that happens, he calms down and you have a nice conversation. But in fact, we had John McCain on the verge of losing his temper. Now, you can argue and debate substantively about the issues, and I think there are good points on either side. But temperamentally, especially in a crisis, the presidency is about character and about a man. We know the Congress is going to be taken over, we assume, by one party. So you're looking for a temperament. And I think John McCain has frankly failed that test. I really do.
Jerry Seib.
Well, I have to assume that one of the things the McCain camp was interested in was drawing Barack Obama into that fight, into that argument. And I thought Senator Obama adopted the classic front-runner strategy, which is to not be drawn into the fight. That I
George Will called it the rope-a-dope strategy. Right. Explain that.
Well, the idea was to get him up on the ropes and just keep pummeling away at him, but not for the sake solely of pummeling away at him, but in hopes that he will then lash back out, and then you would lose this distinction and demeanor that people talk about, you know.
As Joe far cool as Obama is concerned, yeah.
Yeah. And I'm sure there were plenty of Obama supporters around the country who were screaming at their TV sets, you know, fight back, but he didn't. And I think that's because they have concluded, I believe, that presidential demeanor is an asset for Barack Obama now. And that's precisely what I suspect the McCain campaign's interested in puncturing.
The dynamic was the Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote. Obama is the Roadrunner. Beep, beep, he keeps going. McCain constructs these elaborate moments in the campaign to detonate Obama, whether it be William Ayers or whether it be Joe the Plumber, whether it be these quite elaborate schemes, the suspension of the campaign. These are going to be the big ones. And all that happens is that Wile E. Coyote ends up with a little trail of smoke coming out the top of his head. And the coolness of Obama, I mean, just his ability, I mean, let's face it, he's not just being criticized. This is a black man running for president, and it's not psychologically easy to be a black man in America anyway. It's often hard, but to have every coded stereotype, every sense that you really don't belong, every accusation of not really supporting the troops, not actually being a real American, all this stuff, which is enough to drive anybody nuts. He's been subjected to it for 20 months, and he is still completely calm. That's remarkable. I think one has to understand he is a black man. He is being subjected to the kind of things that really would drive you crazy, mm-hmm. and yet he seems able to move on.
You know, that is absolutely true, and I think that what he was doing in the debate was not just something that he needed to do because of the attacks that were being waged at him in the debate, but also to convince people that the other things that they're hearing about him aren't true. Last Saturday morning, I was out in Virginia taking a look at the ground operation for the Republicans in Prince William County, and I saw the Republican state chairman of the state of Virginia, state delegate named Jeff Frederick, literally was sending volunteers out in the field to canvass, telling them Barack Obama and Osama bin Laden have something in common because they both have friends who bombed the Pentagon. And this is the kind of stuff that voters are hearing about Barack Obama.
Now, I understand that last night at the Al Smith dinner, an annual event at which both presidential candidates appeared, the tone was warm, it was comedic, but at the same time, these robocalls were going out from the McCain campaign doing exactly as Karen has just mentioned.
Right, and I think the McCain campaign's response would be, well, let's see, you guys have three times, four times, five times as many negative ads running around the country as we can afford to buy. So, you know,
Is that true?
Well, sure. I mean, the
negative.
Well, everybody. The definition of negative depends is in the eye of the beholder. But I mean, the McCain people are getting swamped by TV advertising by Obama, and a lot of it is critical of, in particular, the McCain health plan. But my point is that a presidential campaign is always turns into what somebody said this week is a knife fight in a phone booth in the last couple of weeks, and that's what's going on right now. I just wanted to say one thing though. I went back and looked at the transcript of the debate, and there was a little more method to what John McCain was doing than I think it may have seemed. He kept coming back not just to an attack on Barack Obama, but to an attack on Obama as a big taxer. I think you finally saw there what the point of it was, is to portray Obama as a lot of things, but mostly as somebody who will raise your taxes. That, I think you have the closing argument for the McCain campaign there, and it was encased in the back and forth in that debate.
Does it work?
It has worked for the Republicans for 25 years. I think it probably doesn't work this year, but people have said that and been wrong before.
The polling shows, I mean, maybe this debate will change the polling, but the polling actually currently shows that more voters think McCain will raise their taxes
right.
than think Obama will, which is pretty staggering.
Right, which is also what he had to turn around in that.
And because Obama, in both the first two debates, very shrewdly immediately talked about his middle-class tax cut, right. which is the Clinton route to fiscal balance. And it also resonates with memories of Clinton. And Clinton does not seem, in retrospect, like some radical lefty growing government. Compared to George Bush, Bill Clinton was a far-right fiscal conservative.
All right. Let's talk for a moment about the 15 minutes of fame that's been brought to Joe Wurzelbacher. Karen.
Well, Joe Wurzelbacher, who at one point Senator McCain referred to as Wurzelburger, is a plumber in Ohio who, on the campaign trail at one point, confronted Barack Obama and told him, I'm trying to buy the business that I work for, and I looked at your tax plan, and as a result, I would be paying more taxes. And the implication there was that this is keeping him from realizing his dream, the American dream, to someday be his own boss. But the McCain campaign pounced on this. And how many times was Joe's name was brought up? More than 20 times during the debate. And now, of course, unfortunately, I think this citizen in Ohio is having every aspect of his life scrutinized.
I really have some sympathy for him that he was caught on camera saying this to Obama. We don't hear what Obama's response is when Joe Wurzelbacher poses this point. The Toledo Blade is reporting, number one, that Joe has no plumber's license. The Ohio Department of Taxation placed a lien against him because of $1,183 in personal property taxes that have not been paid. It's also disclosed, based on divorce records, that Joe's 2006 income, $40,000, hardly enough to qualify for the tax hike he's worried about, but rather puts him into Barack Obama's tax cut category.
Right. And I think Joe the plumber has become a mythical figure, even though there's a real person behind it, and he's a symbol. And these things emerge occasionally. You remember that when Phil Gramm was running for president, he had a real voter back in his district in Texas, Dickie Flats, who he used to say was my template for everything. And Chuck Schumer, by the way, a Democratic senator from New York, made up a family 2 years ago as his template for what everything means to real Americans out there. So that's really what Joe the plumber is. And the reality is very simple. There's an argument about small businesses. Barack Obama says, look, most small businesses, and he's right about this, the vast majority of small businesses are really that. They're small. So they don't make enough money to break his $250,000 income ceiling that would make them vault into a higher tax bracket. Most small businesses do pay taxes at the personal rate, but most of them don't clear that line. The question about Joe the plumber was, well, would he be such a successful plumbing contractor that he would make more than that? And nobody knows the answer to that question. But the McCain campaign's response is, well, that's true, but most of the jobs that are created in America are created by successful small businesses that get beyond that ceiling, and you would hurt them. That's the substantive debate behind Joe the
plumber. In defense of Joe the plumber, he has given more press conferences now than Sarah Palin.
Not by choice, however.
Well, no, it's always a choice, Jerry.
All right.
That's true. And we have a vice presidential candidate who, for the first time in modern political history, refuses to take questions and follow-ups from the press. This is outrageous.
How did you feel about John McCain's response during that debate about his vice presidential choice, Andrew?
He he said, "I'm proud of her," as if he was talking about a daughter of his on a hockey team. I mean, I'm sorry, but the condescension and double standards here about this candidate are just overwhelming.
Karen, how do you feel about that phrase, "I'm proud of her"?
Well, it felt to me like more like we were talking about somebody who was running for first lady, because the, as I recall, the main issue he brought up with in relation to Sarah Palin was what she would do for people with autism, which, of course, is a big problem, but it's not necessarily what you would want to be at the top of the vice president's or the potential president's issue agenda.
How did you feel about it, Jerry?
I thought it was a bad stretch in the debate for John McCain. I was a little surprised that he chose to also go after Joe Biden as opposed to defend Sarah Palin. But on the other hand, you know, Joe Biden has been fairly tough on John McCain. I think they thought they were friends before this campaign. I'm not sure that's the case.
What would you rather do, attack Joe Biden or defend Sarah Palin?
I think at that moment, the compelling need was to explain and defend Sarah Palin.
Well, she's indefensible. There is no rational defense of this choice. It's insane.
Let me ask you all about ACORN, about which there has been a great deal of questions, and now the FBI has opened an investigation into the activities of ACORN. What are they looking for, Andrew?
Well, I don't know what they're looking for, to be honest with you. I think what they're looking for is evidence that volunteers or people paid very basic amount of money to get new voter registrations, which is quite common, fiddled and try to get more cash by filling out fake registration forms.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Karen.
Well, you know, I don't know that paying people by the hour to go out and register voters is a particularly good or efficient way to do it, unless you're going to be absolutely scrupulous about going over the voter registration forms that they turn in.
But, which they have.
Well, and generally, when this has been investigated in the past, and it has in states like Missouri, what they have found is that when people turn in voter registration, these hourly $8-an-hour workers turn these voter registration forms in that say Mickey Mouse or Brett Favre, that actually they're scamming ACORN. They're really not attempting to sort of assume that somebody claiming to be Mickey Mouse is actually going to show up at the polls to vote.
So, Jerry, why is so much attention being focused on ACORN, especially within the conservative press?
Well, this is a spillover from the economic stimulus legislation this year, in which Democrats put in some money for grants to go to organizations like ACORN. And that the Republicans charged at that point that was largely walking around money for the election, that they were going to send money into organizations like ACORN ostensibly to help people cope with the mortgage mess, but that it was in reality going to be turned to register many, many, many people who were going to then vote Democrat in the fall. That's the context of this whole argument, and that's been a lingering source of bitterness and tension between the two parties for several months now.
But now you've got the fate of as many as 200,000 voters in Ohio ending up before the Supreme Court. What's going to happen there?
Well, you know, at this point, this is also because sometimes, you know, people move and their voter registration, I mean, the address on their driver's license isn't the same as the address that they registered under. I mean, I think what is likely to happen is that it's going to be, you know, a lot more chaos at the polls on election day maybe than we would have seen otherwise. But, you know, John McCain, bringing up ACORN and all of the stuff in the debate, characterized this as the most the biggest election fraud ever perpetrated on the American people or something like that. It, you know, again, I don't think the evidence is there for that kind of charge.
Can we be frank here? This is an argument being put out there. It's not about voter fraud. It's about, as Karen said, it's about really scamming ACORN. And it is, I mean, I don't think this should be left alone. I think this kind of thing should be tackled. I'm perfectly happy for this to be investigated myself. But it is not an attempt to rig the election. It can't be, it will not get to that point. And look, ACORN is a largely minority organization. It is about registering minorities, especially African Americans and Latinos in big cities. The bringing it up at this point, out of all proportion to its actual salience as an issue, is entirely a design to polarize racially. It's to give white voters a sense that they're being swamped by all these phony minority votes that the Democratic machine is going to rig the election. That's what, those are the messages, the coded messages going out there. And I think that the emphasis on it, it's a legitimate issue, but the overemphasis on it is about racial polarization.
Jerry?
Well, sure. I mean, most of the argument, and this goes back to 2004 and 2000, most of the arguments about voter registration problems and alleged voter fraud have a racial and a class overtone to them, that the charge of the Republicans is that there is an attempt to sort of get people who will vote Democratic but who really don't qualify to the polls and casting votes. And the Democratic response is that most of the things that the Republicans have done, largely in courts, have been designed to disenfranchise exactly those people, people who would vote Democratic. So it's got both a racial and a class overtone, and it's been that way for the last two cycles, and it'll be that way again this year.
Here's my fear, Jerry, and my fear is that it's being used to delegitimize in advance the results of this election in order to delegitimize President Obama. And it seems to me that whoever wins needs to be legitimately understood as president in this time.
Andrew Sullivan, senior editor at Atlantic Magazine. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe on the web at germany.info. By WAMU's The Conversation, with listener-generated discussions and a monthly online chat with Diane Rehm. More information at conversation.wamu.org. And by the Gruber Family Foundation for support of NPR's international coverage. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
The Friday News Roundup. The U.S. and Iraq appear close to a new security agreement. A soon-to-be-released national intelligence estimate offers a bleak view of the situation in Pakistan, and the U.S. removes North Korea from the list of nations sponsoring terrorism. The Diane Rehm Show next hour. Welcome back, and it's time now to open the phones, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Let's go first to Cincinnati, Ohio. Mario, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Certainly.
Diane, I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt, and I hopefully that you weren't being disingenuous, but it's well over the internet, Obama's response to Joe the Plumber, and it was regarding, and what he responded to him was that he wanted to, quote-unquote, spread the wealth around. And I think the whole issue, which hasn't been dealt with much, is that I think a lot of folks are looking for maybe opportunity to be wealthy, to be made available, and not so much spreading of the wealth. The other comment which I like your guest to address is how quickly they were able to investigate Joe the Plumber, and compare and contrast that to the number of allegations that have been out there with regards to Obama's associations with heirs and the like, and maybe the intensity that those allegations have been also looked into.
Jerry's time.
Well, I have to admit, I have not heard, and I've looked, the words that precise words that Barack Obama said back to Joe the Plumber. I honestly don't know. I think he characterized them himself, and I haven't heard them. And maybe they're out there somewhere. I just don't know. The reality is that they're, you know, the Obama tax plan does involve giving tax credits back to people who don't pay taxes now. And if you want to describe that as spreading the wealth around, that's fine. I don't know whether he characterized it himself that way or not. You know, we haven't spent a lot of time, a lot of reporting resources looking into Joe the Plumber at the Wall Street Journal. I suppose others have. I think the heiress thing is and has been looked into fairly extensively over the last few weeks.
Karen.
Absolutely. Just as recently as a couple of weeks ago, the New York Times devoted not only the front page, but I believe a double truck inside to exhaustively documenting Barack Obama's association with William Ayers and coming to the conclusion that it didn't add up to a lot.
Andrew.
Look, there's always a difference between examining the record over 20 months and examining it over 2 days. The two-day thing with Joe the Plumber feels more intense, but in fact, if you compressed everything that we've covered about Barack Obama over the last 20 months into 6 weeks, it would feel like a whirlwind of scrutiny. And I think that's also with Palin. You see, what the press has tried to do with Palin, and I think largely failed, at least failed to a great extent, is to do the same vetting because McCain didn't vet her. It feels more intense because it's concentrated into 6 weeks. But in fact, I think it's pretty equivalent to the kind of raking over the coals that the Obama record has gone through.
All right, let's now go to Moore County, North Carolina. Marion, you're on the air.
Well, good morning, Diane. Morning. What a great panel you have this morning.
I think so, too.
Yes, indeed. Well, I'm calling because, I've been following politics for 50 years. I met John Kennedy when he was a young senator, made a speech in Raleigh, North Carolina, my hometown, and it's sort of like being struck by lightning, as you might imagine. But I have to say, after all the years of following politics, this year I just feel incredibly sad about the campaign that John McCain is running. I just think it's very contradictory. I mean, he's just like John McContradiction or something. He keeps trying to figure out, you know, how to reinvent himself so that he can take some votes away from, you know, Barack Obama. And I don't think he's doing that at all. And a couple of examples right on, you know, I listen to NPR all the time. I don't even watch television much. But on point last week, there was a group of economists, and they brought up the fact that 21 of the top contributors to John McCain are mortgage lenders.
All right. Thanks for your call. Any comments?
I think that if John McCain had gotten the running mate he wanted, Joe Lieberman, and had run as the experienced centrist independent on foreign policy and a steady hand, it would be close.
Why didn't he?
Because the religious right vetoed it.
All right. We have just gotten word that Mike Allen with Politico is reporting that Colin Powell will be on Meet the Press Sunday and may endorse Obama, or will endorse Obama. Karen?
This has been the subject of a fair amount of speculation. Both candidates met with Colin Powell, I believe it was about 3 months ago. This would be an extraordinary endorsement. Powell had said that he would possibly endorse, that he was going to wait to see who the two candidates picked as their running mates. He wanted to see the conventions. He wanted to see the debates. So this would be exactly the moment when this endorsement would be coming. And I think it would be an extraordinary boost to Barack Obama.
I want to ask you all about a report in the Washington Post this week on White House approval of waterboarding. What did the story say, Andrew?
What it did was for the first time provide written evidence that this White House has authorized torture. We already knew that they had offered oral evidence. Oral authorization. What we are discovering, which is a matter of fact at this point, is that the president and vice president have authorized torture in violation of American law, in violation of the Geneva Conventions and in violation of the UN Convention Against Torture. We also know that they have told untruths about that in denying that they have done what we know now to be true. This is an extraordinary situation, Diane. I mean, I think it's the gravest actual underlying situation we face.
Karen.
Yeah, Andrew is right. We knew that they had authorized, you know, sort of the general concept of aggressive techniques. This was
torture, Karen.
This is them specifically authorizing a technique, waterboarding, which absolutely, I think, just about anybody would agree amounts to torture. And the fact that the CIA went to them and asked them for this authorization tells us that the CIA also knew that if this ever became public, it was going to become extraordinarily controversial. What I believe we don't know at this point is who exactly in the White House signed this memo.
Yeah, that's still the mystery. The story I thought established that there was a paper trail, but it didn't establish who was at the beginning or even in the middle of that paper trail. So I don't. There's more to be done.
The President of the United States and the Vice President of the United States have obviously explicitly authorized torture. That is simply not disputable. The principals' meetings. Now they've done everything they can to give Bush some verbal formulation and to give him plausible deniability, but no one seriously believes that this happened without his knowledge or without his active consent. And we are talking here, this is not rhetoric, we're talking legally about a war crime. So at some point in the next 4 to 8 years, the United States is going to have to come to terms with how do we start to investigate, how do we start to hold accountable. Do we have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission? Do we give these people immunity in order to get the information out? Or do we actually start prosecuting the President and Vice President, Defense Secretary, and all the principals who authorized war crimes?
All right. I want to go back to our earlier caller's point about Obama's response to Joe the Plumber. A video clip caught by Fox News shows Obama replying, quote, "It's not that I want to punish your success. I just want to make sure that everybody who is behind you, that they've got a chance at success too. And I think that when we spread the wealth around, it's good for everybody." Any comments?
Well, that's pretty much what Senator Obama himself said at the debate. I mean, that's in keeping with how he characterized his response to Joe the Plumber. I don't think there's a shocking, you know, revelation there.
I'm a flat taxer. I agree with Joe the Plumber on this. I'm a libertarian. I believe in the same tax rates for everybody. But look, what Obama is proposing does not feel terribly redistributionist to me, given the enormous gains in wealth of the top 2 or 3% of the country over the last 8 years. And I think Obama's pragmatic response is, yes, sure, but come on. We've got to pay for something. And if the people earning more than $250,000 a year can't pay some more taxes, who will?
And on that note, let's go to Joe in Warrenton, Virginia. Good morning to you.
Good morning. And no, I'm not a plumber. In reference to the financial debacle, what I find very troubling, I've heard a few sound bites to the effect from NPR, in fact, that a lot of these CEOs, if not all of them, were shoveling huge amounts of money out the back door in terms of retirement packages and golden parachutes, while we as the government throw a rescue package in the front door. I mean, they are literally raping the companies days before they're going under. And I'd like to know if anybody is addressing that, and if so, to what degree.
Karen.
Well, the bailout package, the original one approved by Treasury, did have some requirements, some restrictions on executive compensation for the companies that choose to take advantage of this package. But I think Joe has his finger on why so many people out in the country are so angry about this. And by the way, this is not just reverberating through the presidential race. This is reverberating down the ballot. There are a lot of Republican senators whose jobs now are basically in jeopardy because they supported this bailout package.
Jerry.
Well, and watch this space. I mean, there's going to be more on this. You're going to have a series of hearings next year, I suspect, in Congress looking at what happened inside some of these companies in the weeks and months before they were sold, before, in the case of Lehman Brothers, they went belly up, or before the government stepped in to save them. I think there will be a lot of sort of books opened and questions asked. We're only at the beginning of that process, I suspect.
It's here's an email from Will in Cavendish, Vermont. He says, we need to recognize, as Paul Krugman points out in his column today, that the underlying problem with the economy is the recession, which is far greater than the credit crunch that reporters talk about. As people lose jobs, companies shut down, there's a lack of confidence in the future ability of people to repay loans. That's the biggest reason for the market's problems as anything else. Why don't the politicians and the press talk more about the need to head off the coming depression? Do you believe we have a coming depression, Jerry?
No, I don't. I think there's a danger of that. But I do, as I said earlier, I think the reason the market shot up was because of relief over the financial markets problem getting under control, and then it shot down because of realizations that even after that happens, there's the reverberation, which is probably a deep and painful recession, but I don't think a depression, no.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And to St. Louis, Missouri, good morning, Peg.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is related to Sarah Palin. Does anybody on your panel know if she actually has expertise of some special kind in autism, or if John McCain was confusing autism and Down syndrome?
Anybody have a comment? Karen?
You know, I was actually wondering that myself, because he repeatedly referred to her. I believe there may be a sister or somebody in her family who has a child who has autism, but, you know, what people more associate with her is the fact that she has a baby with Down syndrome.
Two things. The term special needs does explicitly include autism and Down syndrome. Secondly, a lot of my own readers who are parents of children with special needs will point out that you only really know what it's like until when they grow up. I mean, that a four-month-old is really not that big a learning curve. It's when children with special needs grow up a little older that the real stresses and strains and joys, of course. And I think that the decision to bring a child with Down syndrome into the world as opposed to aborting it, as 90% of them are, is a beautiful and important and sacred thing. And I think that's a beautiful thing. And insofar as this absurd candidacy, has done that, at least, then I think it's a good thing.
When you say this absurd candidacy, are you speaking about Palin?
Yes.
All right.
I'm just speaking about appointing someone who isn't even faintly qualified to do the job she's supposed to do.
All right. And finally, to Raleigh, North Carolina. Good morning, Joe. You're on the air.
Good morning, and I'm also not a plumber. I just want to make some comments on the fact that McCain and Palin both running as mavericks. It seems to be hurting the other Republicans in that they're really not – I mean, they're running against the Republican Party, and also the fact that George Bush seems to be completely absent from campaigning for his fellow Republicans.
What do you think, Jerry?
Well, I think that's an interesting point. There was some speculation. There is still some speculation among Republicans about whether one of the closing arguments that John McCain will make explicitly, and I haven't heard him make it quite this explicitly yet, is don't turn the whole thing over to the Democrats. Vote for me because you know they're going to win big in the Senate and in the House, and you don't want them in charge of everything, so that's a reason to vote for me, which would essentially throw his congressional colleagues off the back of the truck.
Can,
he hasn't quite done that yet.
Can McCain turn this around in 18 days?
Well, look, I think it'll get tighter than it is now. I don't know whether he can turn it around. And if you look at the Electoral College map as opposed to the percentages in polls, you still see a way McCain can win this. I don't know whether he will, but I do think that these things tend to get tighter as you get closer.
And I do want to clarify that Mike Allen reported in Politico.com that Colin Powell may, not will, but may endorse Barack Obama. Any last words, Andrew?
I think these races do tend to tighten in the last 18 days. However, I do think that the mood of the country and Obama's ground game could mean they might even widen.
Andrew Solomon, senior editor at Atlantic Monthly, Karen Tumulty, reporter for Time Magazine, Jerry Seib, executive Washington editor for The Wall Street Journal. Thank you all so much. Have a great, peaceful weekend. Enjoy yourselves. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.